Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Haiti Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. This week, we'll talk about the Nobel Peace Prize. Africa has had many illustrious and some controversial Nobel laureates. But what happens when a Peace Prize winner falls from grace? We'll also discuss the Nobel Prize in Literature. Are the awards in step with the times and relevant to Africans? We'll speak to a Kenyan critic who says perhaps it's time the continent has its own Nobel-style awards. Straight Talk Africa starts now. The Nobel Peace Prize. How does it work, and how do you win one? The Nobel Prizes were founded by the inventor of dynamite, Alfred Nobel, and the Peace Prize is supposed to go to the person who has done the most or best to advance fellowship among nations, the abolition of standing armies, and the establishment and promotion of peace congresses. Prize winners are decided by five people from the Norwegian Nobel Committee, who are appointed by the Norwegian Parliament. And what does a laureate get? A medal, a diploma, about $1.1 million, and of course the immediate prestige and global attention. Now, Africa has had a wide range of illustrious Nobel Peace Prize winners, including South Africa's anti-apartheid activists Albert Luthuli, Desmond Tutu, and Nelson Mandela. Ghana's Kofi Annan, Kenya's environmentalist Wangari Maathai, and renowned gynecologist Dr. Denis Mukwege from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, two laureates have returned to the spotlight. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 for his role in ending hostilities with neighboring Eritrea. But Ethiopia is now in the midst of an internal conflict that has left tens of thousands dead, and a possible full-blown civil war is threatening to tear that country apart. Abiy's government forces are fighting with a coalition of rebels led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which dominated Ethiopian politics for 27 years as a repressive regime. Abiy says it is an existential fight, and he's declared he would lead his army to the warfront himself. The death last month of South Africa's last apartheid president, Frederick Willem de Klerk, has brought to the forefront questions about whether he deserved a Nobel Peace Prize. De Klerk shared the prize with Nelson Mandela in 1993, as you'll remember, for his role in bringing an end to white minority rule in South Africa. But now there are new questions about de Klerk's legacy, especially considering a video released recently in which he appears to say from the grave what he never really said when he was alive.
I, without qualification, apologize for the pain and the hurt and the indignity and the damage that apartheid has done to black, brown, and Indians in South Africa. I do so not only in my capacity as the former leader of the National Party, but also as an individual.
Well, South Africans remain split about how history should judge the man who, as president, presided over apartheid and the violence that upheld it, but who also brought that system of racial segregation to an end. Zahir Kassim is in South Africa for us and asked people on the streets of Johannesburg whether they think de Klerk deserved a Nobel Peace Prize.
Personally, I don't believe de Klerk deserved the Nobel Peace Prize because of the factor of, you know, as black South Africans, I believe that he was forced to release Nelson Mandela out of prison. Without the pressure that the black people were putting back then on the government, he wouldn't have even thought about that. He was just happy to be in power during that time.
I think in the context of what was happening at the time, I think a lot of people felt that it was deserved. I'm pretty agnostic about the man. I do think that he was a force for change, ultimately. But I do think it was in the face of a lot of pressure. But I wouldn't take away from his achievements by saying no.
I think it was a proper decision to give him a Nobel Peace Prize because it was in recognition of the fact that he gave up power from a position of strength. The only other person that I know in recent history who has done that is Gorbachev, the former leader of the Russian Union. The fact that de Klerk was in a position of power and the fact that he appreciated that giving up a position of power would herald a new era where people could work together for a better future, to me marked the strengths of him as a leader.
Honestly, not really. I don't feel that. Because at the end of the day, yes, de Klerk didn't create apartheid, but he played a role in it. And if ever, I still say apartheid would have ended, whether he was still the president or not. But apartheid was due to end at any time, so I don't think he should have.
I believe looking at the transformation of the country, talking about the previous government before 1994, yes, I do believe he did deserve, because looking at the government itself, because the same F.W. de Klerk, he was also being a deputy president of Mr. Mandela in 1994. So yes, I believe he did play a big role in terms of deserving a Nobel Peace Prize winners.
And South Africans there reflecting on the legacy of F.W. de Klerk. So what makes a peacemaker? And do these examples of awarding Nobel Peace Prizes to leaders who have not necessarily had a lifetime of accomplishment in peace efforts undercut the legitimacy of the award? I asked my guests these questions. Salem and Pipo Kushle, a warm welcome to both of you. Let's do some introductions, although I consider you friends of the show, but we just want everybody else to get to know you. Salem Solomon is a lead editor here at The Voice of America, and Pipo Kushle Mnyandu is a lecturer of African Studies and Culture at Howard University. And so, Salem, first question to you. At the time Ethiopia's Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize, what did that prize do for him on the global stage, on the continent, and what did it do for him at home?
Going back to the time when he got his, when he was awarded the prize, not a lot of people knew about Abiy Ahmed, you know, even internally. When you think about, you know, his credibility rose because of the prize, and the prize also buoyed his basically credibility internationally speaking, because you know, he was this unknown figure internally, but the gesture to end a long 20-year-old, you know, conflict, a stalemate that has been between the two countries, really made a huge difference because it brought him to an international stage. But in terms of his resume, when you think about what he accomplished in the past, you know, he was known as, you know, the founder of like this information network security agency, which basically spied on a lot of people that were outside part of the previous government. But he was part of the EPRDF, the ruling party prior to his coming. And so and he also served as a soldier himself in the fight that basically he took credit for ending between my home country, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. And so, as I said, internationally, not a lot was known about him. He was this, you know, young, reform-minded leader, and that's how we reported about him as well. But that the fact that he made peace between these two countries is what made him, you know, known internationally. And also, you know, a lot of times when the Nobel Peace Prize Committee looks at a candidate, they try to find something that would, you know, make a big impact on a global stage. And that war was ending that war was what made him more important. And you can see it in their writing as well. You know, they were very deliberate in the way that they awarded the Peace Prize. They specifically said the initiative, because it was the start of the peace. And we can talk about what happened later, but it was the start of a peace in the making. And in the writing, also identified him as making a decisive initiative to resolve a peace. But we've seen intractable, conflicts flaring up, displacing people within Ethiopia leading up to the Peace Prize. In fact, millions were displaced within Ethiopia, and there were a lot of issues that were simmering in Ethiopia. And so in terms of priority, when you think about the peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea, it was not really high up. Ethnic conflict that still reverberates until today. There were a lot of issues still ongoing that he could have gotten, to work right away when he became the prime minister. But the peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea was what made him recognizable. And so, yeah, just to summarize what your question is about, what it did for him, gave him credibility internationally.
And Pewa Kushle, of course, I have the same question for you about Frederick Willem de Klerk. Here's that famous image of de Klerk accepting the Nobel Peace Prize alongside Nelson Mandela in 1993. What did the Peace Prize do for him internationally and at home?
The fact that you are an apartheid president, you're not a leader of a Sunday school choir, okay? You're with all the requisites and the attendant violence that it entailed, right? And in South Africa, if you're thinking about the most virulent acts of violence took place between actually 1990 and 94, the time of de Klerk's presidency. So you see, so this criticism of de Klerk, this negative perspective of him, not as a peacemaker, but as a wily politician who sought to ride the unassailable wind of peace and recognition of the South African miracle. And it was almost inevitable that, for example, Mr. Mandela would receive the Nobel Prize. Many people then, from this perspective, looked at de Klerk sharing the stage with Nelson Mandela as having taken away from kind of the wind of the liberation movement, because it was not only Nelson Mandela, of course, he was involved, it was his comrades. So they looked at it that way. However, there's the other perspective that may be positive about de Klerk that says, look, whoever was a president between 1990 and 1994 had to have some sense of courage to be able to confront those vested, violent Afrikaner interests that were real. With the perspective of hindsight, it's very easy for us now to gainsay and say, well, he should have. But if you know how apartheid worked, the violence and the military complex that he had to convince basically to play ball, he then deserved to be recognized more so for the peace he made within his own people.
Now, of course, for those of us who grew up under de Klerk's rule, you and I both know what that feels like. It is hard to sum up, of course, our views of the man, but thank you for that very balanced assessment. Salem, I'm sure we can agree that the headlines about Abiy Ahmed have changed dramatically since he won the Nobel Peace Prize and what we see play out in Ethiopia today. Give us a sense of how Abiy Ahmed is being covered in the media now. I'm talking about the man himself, his character. How is he being reported on internationally and in his own country?
That's a very good question, Haiti. A lot of people are referencing his Nobel Peace Prize speech. I'll read an excerpt here for you, actually, because, as I said, not a lot of people knew about him before coming on the position he's in right now. But he was a soldier, more importantly, and a soldier who fought during the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. And in the speech, in the Nobel Peace Prize speech, he said, he admitted to the fact that, politicians talk about peace in theory, but he was speaking from experience, and that made it so powerful. And I remember even prior to the Peace Prize, he was sitting in the House of Representatives in Ethiopia speaking about a family member he buried in the war between the two countries in like this small town that was the flashpoint of the conflict between the two countries. He said, I crawled out of my way to peace, he says. you know, out of dusty trenches of war years ago. I was a young soldier. When war broke between Ethiopia and Eritrea, you can feel, you know, you can feel that it was genuine. And so that was very powerful. And a lot of international media right now reference that speech because just a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's very rare, even in modern history and on the continent, it's very rare for a head of state, for a prime minister to wear military fatigue and go to the front lines. And that's exactly what he's doing. And so you can see the headlines, especially in international media, you know, the Nobel laureate, peace Nobel laureate going to the front lines is what is, I mean, everywhere you go, most of the coverage has been like that. But most importantly, you know, besides the fact that, you know, that he made peace between my home country, Eritrea, what really was resonating with a lot of people in the international community and people who are watching from abroad is the fact that he released a lot of political prisoners. He, you know, was making headway in terms of, you know, freedom of press. Journalists that were arrested were all freed. And that was an extremely, you know, intriguing aspect of like what direction he was taking the country. And now, speaking of, you know, the relationship between international media and the government right now is a completely 180 because a couple of weeks ago, in fact, the last story I reported was on the, you know, the nature and the way that people are able to report about the war. They can't. You know, reporting has essentially become criminalized unless, you know, you say something positive about the, you know, war development or something positive that really, you know, hails the progress that the government is doing. We see, you know, reporters being imprisoned simply for sometimes reporting the truth within the country. And they had, you know, the media authority arm of the government had a warning for CNN, BBC, you name it, for any international media that doesn't really, you know, that reports unflatteringly about the government. And so when you think about what the international media and how the international media is covering the events right now, there's a lot of frustration because there's media blackout, first of all. And second, the optics of a prime minister wearing fatigues, military fatigues, that let alone a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, is not really looking well. And when you think about also leading up to the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, he came to the to Washington D.C. to talk to the diaspora because he has a lot of support in the diaspora. There was euphoria. I remember I was reporting here in Washington D.C. when he was trying to, you know, energize the diaspora so that they can come back and contribute economically or in any way they can. There was an overwhelming feeling about him as a person, as someone who, you know, was a unifying force and united Ethiopians in the spirit of peace and reconciliation because they were coming out of, you know, a 30-plus year rule of more of the same what's happening right now. And so he was seen as this uniting personality that really brought people together because of his really diverse background. He was seen as someone who brought people together within the country and abroad. Of course, he had some detractors, like people who didn't really support him, but that was the nature of how he was regarded.
One more on Declare Pio Kushle, and then we'll have to move on. Now, his death reignited conversation about who he really was and what his place in history is. But for me, the big question that had always hung over de Klerk was this issue of an apology for apartheid. He was criticized for being really obtuse. Sometimes he would apologize, take it back. He would never quite say what black South Africans needed him to say. Then in the end, he gives this really strange, beyond the grave type of apology, taped before his death and released after his passing. How was that received in the moment, and how will it be perceived in history?
Most South Africans right now because of the economic situation. Much of South African, especially the youth, they basically traverse a boulevard of broken dreams, you know. Unemployment for what, 34% the last I checked, 75% of the unemployed or the youth are unemployed. And they graduate, or what in South Africa we call matriculation. They matriculate right into unemployment. There's even a term which is an understatement of the year. It's called economically inactive, you know. I'd rather use the term, you know, economically displaced. So the South Africa of today then has had ample time to be retrospective about the past, starting in 1994 onwards. The kind of implicit agreements that were made kind of between the vested interests in South Africa, which are going to be business, they're going to be white, if we are be plain spoken here. And it was that in exchange for this stability and kind of letting things lie and kind of not seeking justice, the business interests in South Africa would pour money into the economy. The economy would grow precipitously, well-being will go down to the youth, the masses of black people will be happy. We know the opposite has taken place. So then this has been fuel for this retrospective on behalf of the youth. So when you observe Twitter then, you see a bifurcation of opinion based on one, privilege. How has your life been since 1994 and up till today? If it's not well, for a majority of South African young people, it's not. That we have a very dim view of De Klerk, even without that much information about him. So the fact that he's white, he presided over the last apartheid government. They don't even have to know the specifics. So because they know that today the certain level of privilege is still encrusted along those lines. And so that's one perspective. But another perspective is a liberal one. There's some blacks who are elites now, whose lives have gotten markedly better post-1994. So they will have a more nuanced view of De Klerk. They will be happy to understand the full picture of the man and his complexity and the complex decision-making that took place in his life, political life. Within this camp, there will also then be found a large group of his own people, the Afrikaner and some white people. I'm being generalistic here, but I've painted two groups of people, and both based on a certain level of privilege and a certain level of unfulfilled dreams, because I'm trying to link this idea that politicians like De Klerk, they don't do whatever good or bad they do. They don't do it in a vacuum. It has effect on people's economic lives, you know, and when those lives don't turn out quite well, the people often have an unflattering view in retrospect, and they judge quite harshly.
Now, I also want to talk about some other controversial Nobel laureates in other parts of the world as well. Aung San Suu Kyi of Myanmar, who is now facing very, very hefty prison sentence. And she was quite the democracy darling who eventually fell from grace. And then the controversy, of course, here in the United States around former President Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. Salem, first walk us through the controversy around Obama's Peace Prize.
Thank you, Haiti. I remember the first time I saw, like, you know, this controversy around, you know, is, you know, the getting the Nobel Peace Prize prematurely, is it really worth even giving it? There was an interesting article in the British newspaper, the Financial Times, titled "The Curse of the Premature Nobel Peace Prize." In it, the author, the AFCA editor, David Pilling, one of my favorite writers, says the committee jumped the gun, no pun intended in the case of Ethiopia, started with the, you know, example of a former U.S. president, President Barack Obama, 2009. He was, you know, he was awarded because the committee thought maybe he would bring peace to the Middle East, which is a daunting task. And also, of course, as you mentioned, Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi, as when she was, you know, under house arrest, you know, she was regarded as someone who championed freedom and democracy and defended freedom and democracy at the time in 1991. The criticism, of course, is that, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi went to become head of state And has been widely criticized for the persecution of the Rohingya, you know, the minority, the country's Muslim minority, the Rohingya, which is now there's like debate about what to label the atrocities that have happened, horrible atrocities in Myanmar. With Obama, the initial criticism was that, you know, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize during his first year in office and was actually nominated not long after his inauguration, if I remember correctly, the timeline. And many saw his, you know, prize as an anti-Bush, quote unquote. And I've read a lot about this. They labeled it as an anti-Bush Nobel because he was coming right after the Bush administration, and the award was, criticized after Obama got it because he maintained many of the policies from the previous administrations, including the use of drones and actually expansion of the war in Afghanistan, with the troop surge. And you know how that war ended as well. And so people questioned whether these were actions of someone who, you know, was committed for peace, which is exactly what we're talking about here in terms of Ethiopia as well. While, you know, defenders of Obama or those who, you know, speak on, you know, how he deserved it would say that, you know, he was pushing for a foreign policy that was best for the U.S. interest. But he saw the use of force as really a necessity or necessary to ensure that there would be a long-term peace. And he believed that he shouldn't be, you know, constrained by the prize. In fact, he spent a lot of time debating about what or explaining the concept of quote-unquote just war, you know. And fast forward to what's happening now with Ethiopia, and I'll quote you here from his spokesperson just recently, I think this week, December, his spokesperson said, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize, and I'm reading here verbatim from what she said, should not be a shackle for inaction, she says, when a nation is overtly threatened by internal terrorists colluding with external forces, is what she says. What they're saying here is that, you know, just because someone has the Nobel Peace Prize and the existence of the country is threatened by what they've labeled or the group that they've labeled as terrorists, Is it not his duty to go in the front lines, is what they're arguing. So it's an interesting debate to have. It's an interesting conversation, just like what I said with Obama. He, you know, was explaining to any critic or any criticism that was coming his way to debate, you know, long term. This is in the best interest of the U.S. But I think we're seeing also that reflected in what's happening in Ethiopia right now.
And we'll have more from my discussion with Salem Solomon and Pio Kushlemnyandu after the break. I'll also speak to a Kenyan critic who says perhaps it's time Africa had its own Nobel Prize in Literature. All of that just ahead.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa on VOA. We're discussing the Nobel Peace Prize and some of its more controversial winners. Here's more now from my conversation with Pio Kushlemnyandu and Salem Solomon. Pio Kushle, do these examples of awarding peace prizes to people who have not necessarily had a lifetime record of accomplishment undercut the legitimacy of the award in some way?
I would say no, because there's an aspirational aspect to the Nobel Prize, Nobel Peace Prize. One, so there are two aspects. One is to reward for work done, And another one is to what Salem has ably explained to us, and thanks, is this idea that is to recognize effort, initial effort, initial sacrifice, because decisions must be made. You must confront vested interests within your camps in order to make what some people have called the peace of the brave. You must be quite brave to make peace, actually. We underestimate how brave leaders must be to face their own and be accused of traitor. In South Africa, that took place for Mandela and de Klerk, in other words, the liberation movement and so on and so forth. So there's an aspirational aspect of the prize that's it's meant to kind of give you kudos and recognize you and then help you or shepherd you towards better decisions. However, we must be realistic also. And how do you get a Nobel Peace Prize? A committee in, not actually in Sweden, as we think. The money comes from Sweden, but it's a committee of five Norwegian politicians. I think, Anger Andersen, Clement Freidner. I think the fifth one, Tijo, is actually a scorer. But so these are politicians. So and the attendant subjective orientations that a typical Norwegian parliamentarian may have at any particular time. Some of this kind of orientation may be kind of a Euro-liberal reticence towards, rash justice decisions, kind of this glamour to the center, and to reward centrists around the world, because they're the people from whom usually peace comes. And in the case of in South Africa, the Nobel Prize was given just like it was given to the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, in the sense that it was to encourage for work that they had yet to do. The constitution had not been drafted. CODESA had not taken place, okay? And some of the political violence was still ongoing. And so it may be interesting for scholars to look and see if it had a deleterious effect on the violence itself. So there's that aspirational aspect of it that I still think the Nobel, it still makes me think the Nobel Prize is still it's still quite worth its adulation, I would say.
And Salem, the Nobel Peace Prize has for a long time now been dogged by criticism, especially in international media, about how noble it really is. What's your read on that?
When you think about giving the prize to a sitting head of state or someone who already has a platform in early stages, his career or her career, depending on, because their resume is incomplete. I think it's a balancing act. And the reason is because, the committee that gives the award, I didn't know them by name, but they want to be relevant. They want to be timely. And they want to award it to someone an effort to support an effort at peace, a peace that is ongoing. And so, and they want the recipient to use the award for something that can be timely and continuation of the work, ongoing peace. And so if they give the award, say, for instance, for things that happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 100 years ago, wouldn't have the same impact. That's one way to look at it. And by the same token, the risk is that because the person who begins to show some sort of direction in the way the peace is going to maybe be implemented in his or her country, maybe may change later in their career, depending on the context of what's happening on the ground. And so it's a balancing act.
And let me just nominate Pipo Kushle here for some sort of award for his ability to both list and pronounce all those names of the Norwegian Nobel Committee. Pipo, what makes for a peacemaker? What would you say should be considered, particularly in the African context, when deciding who and what a peacemaker is?
I even hate to say this. It may disappoint people and be, anticlimactic. It must be, you see by which country needs work, by who gets the kind of the Nobel Peace Prize, more generally speaking. The fact that the last 27 Nobel Prizes given to Africans. I think 13 have been for peace. So it tells you that there's a lot of peace that has been, you know, that has been needed to have been worked on the African continent. And of those 13, only two are non-politicians. So I'm sorry to disappoint people. You need to be a politician. You need to, because that's where the decisions are made over people's lives. Okay. I think the exceptions are Mama Wangai Maathai in Kenya, and Doctor in the DRC, the doctor who helped a lot.
Yeah.
So the rest are politicians. So there is, I know we don't like politicians a lot as just regular people, but those are the people that have the monopoly of the state power. These are the policy-making elites with whom we must engage. So what makes a Nobel Peace Prize recipient that is worthy? A brave person. A brave person, especially brave not to sit down for negotiations, but also to disappoint some of your supporters and be a leader and lead from the front and be able to see the winds of change. Here is where de Klerk was brave. And this is not even flattering for de Klerk. De Klerk was brave because he saw, he was prescient enough to know the Berlin Wall has fallen, the game is changing. Black Americans in the United States have put enough pressure against South Africa that most South Africans who are white in America are persona non grata and their entities. So this can't go on any longer. The fact that apartheid it lived for so long, it means that if you ask me, it would have gone on for another 5 years if it could, okay? So it couldn't, though, because of these winds of change. And so de Klerk saw and sought to secure his people's place within the liberal order of South Africa. And the way to secure his people's place and to have them not be persona non grata in South Africa was to go through the route of peace and to sometimes confront the one from the Freedom Front. And he succeeded in that for his own judging as a scholar and an analyst for the utility for his own people. He did that. So you must be brave to confront your own people and you must be brave to sit down. I think that's a start. You must be a politician. I'm sorry. At least in the African context.
I want to add on the context part when he's talking about, you know, the context and in the African context. Yes, it is true. Most of them are politicians, like what you rightly pointed out. It is true that the Peace Prize is often given for the acts of international significance. And so someone who negotiates peace between the two nations or organizes an international effort is more likely to receive an award than someone who negotiates peace, say, for instance, in the African context, you know, within communities, small communities or between ethnic groups, say, for instance, inside a country. Ethiopia is a perfect example. There are a lot of community leaders unsuccessfully right now trying to make peace between ethnic groups. You know, these are unsung heroes within small communities in the context of Africa. So, and if you think about the continent as well, some of the most violent clashes right now are occurring on the continent are intercommunal clashes. When you go to West Africa, over resources sometimes. And so those require a very different type of mediation and a different type of peacemaking than the peace agreements that you would see between countries or nations. And so it really needs to be thought of in terms of context as well when you're thinking about the prize.
And Salim, do you think the Nobel Peace Prize just makes more sense to people when they go to ordinary change makers? Not necessarily politicians. I mean, look at this year's recipient, journalist Maria Ressa of the Philippines. And then Africa's had all these other illustrious winners in the past. Kenya's Wangari Maathai, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Denis Mukwege, and of course, South Africa's Desmond Tutu. What's your take on this?
I think that's an interesting argument. And there's a reason for that. When the prize goes to someone who works on a grassroots level, pushing for human rights advocacy, human rights advocate, or the prize itself elevates their stature, and it does it in a global level. That's so important because it shines a light on their cause and gives them a voice that they might not have in their home countries or anywhere else. And so that's one thing that's important. And likewise, it also might serve as a way to protect them. Because we've seen in Maya Reza's case, you know, she's facing imprisonment, all kinds of trumped up charges. And so it can protect people like her and people who were not powerful from imprisonment, from harm, from any kinds of, you know, at the hands of state forces, at the hands of, you know, people in power. And so there's that aspect of it when you think about it. And so it has a real life impact immediately. And it becomes much more politically difficult for authoritarians to, or the most autocratic regimes like, you know, what's happening in Philippines, to imprison a Nobel Prize laureate. And so there's that aspect of it when you think about it. On the other hand, also, when the committee, you know, they want the largest impact, obviously, and that's why they look for something that has international, aspect of it. And so it rewards a head of state, for instance, that already has a platform and is negotiating peace between the two countries or two nations, like what we said before. And so that kind of encouragement can make peace last. I'm being hopeful here. being very hopeful. And so that gesture goes a long way because of the recognition that the person might get. And so, as I said earlier, it is a balancing act. But I think on the grassroots level, on the, you know, people who don't have power, it serves double purpose of also protecting them and making sure that they're safe.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Salem Solomon is a lead editor here at The Voice of America, and Piwo Kushle Mnyandu is a lecturer of African Studies and Culture at Howard University. Piwo Kushle is also the author of the book South Africa-China Relations Between Aspirations and Reality in a New Global Order. Piwo, Salem, thank you so much for your time, your perspectives. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well, coming up after the break. Is it time Africa had its own Nobel-style prize? We'll speak to the Kenyan author and critic who says, yes, it is. He'll tell us why after the break. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. There was jubilation and pleasant surprise in Africa and other parts of the world when Zanzibar-born novelist Abdulrazak Gurnah won the 2021 Nobel Prize in Literature. Surprise because most Africans, including Tanzanians, had never heard of him or his work. Gurnah lives in the United Kingdom and writes about the effects of colonialism, the refugee experience, and displacement. Gurnah's award has raised questions about whether the Nobel Prize in Literature is in step with the times and in touch with Africa. Alexander Ndiritu is a Kenyan author, playwright, and a critic, and he believes the Nobel Prizes are irrelevant to Africans. I spoke to him and asked him why he feels that way.
Yes. Now, speaking specifically about the Nobel Prize for Literature, which is one that concerns me the most, you know, as a writer. When you look at the history of the Nobel Prizes in general, they began in 1901. So they've been around for slightly over 120 years. Now, in that time period, Africa has barely featured. There are individual countries that have won the Nobel Prize for Literature many more times than the entire African continent combined. Nations like Sweden, France, Germany, the UK, and the USA have all won the Nobel Prizes for the Nobel Prize for Literature more times than the entire African continent, a continent of right now about 1.3 billion people. So in all those 100 plus years, only about five Africans have ever won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So Africa is clearly overlooked. This notion of an award that is administrated completely abroad, it's shrouded in secrecy, and amongst people like myself, in the literary fraternity in Africa, we have a lot of discussions about why we give so much relevance to this award. Instead of creating our own prizes, I mean, and nominating and awarding our own literary heroes, presenting our heroes to the world, not waiting for the world to tell us who our heroes are. And one quick example is the most recent Nobel Prize went to a Tanzanian author called Abdul Razak. And immediately the announcement went out, even in Africa, the reaction amongst the literati, when his name was announced, the general reaction was, who? Because this, he has written about 10 novels, but he's from Tanzania, yes, but he has lived in the UK for five decades, 50 years. He is not known even in his own country. One poet from Zanzibar, the actual island where he comes from, said that if you were to show a picture of him in to the Zanzibaris, they would be seeing that image for the first time.
Alex, what does a Nobel Prize in Literature do for an author's career, especially African authors, and especially in their home countries and on the continent?
Well, a prize like that does wonders for that individual author. Although, when you do the research, over the years, their people actually became obscure or more obscure after winning it than they were before. It's a kind of jinx, and a couple of people have actually declined it in the past. One of them saying that he didn't want to be quote unquote institutionalized. The question is whether it actually has any benefit beyond the one individual who wins it. I would say not much. In fact, it would be more inspirational if it came from Africa itself.
Now, Alex, you talk about the secrecy of these prizes, and of course, most people are not part of the sort of writer fraternity like you are, but I'm curious about what goes into the creation of these awards. So if you were to, say, design a Nobel Prize in Literature just for Africa, what would that look like? And are there current models or blueprints like the alternative Nobel Prize that you would draw from? Or do you think Africa needs something completely different and unique that hasn't been done or seen before?
In Africa, and in particular West Africa, there was a particular character in the community that was referred to as the griot. Now, the griot was like a living library, and he played a very important role. He was so important that if he died, it would be like a library burning down. So, and his work in the community was to keep and to narrate the stories of the community, you know, the genealogy, the legends, the myths, all this oral literature. So he, and what at that time the culture, the communication was very oral, so and mostly they would sing apart from narrating, they would sing a lot of songs, giving the stories of the community, the genealogy and all that kind of thing. So it was very important. And what they would do is that he would train somebody else, he would tell these stories to somebody else, usually a relative like a son, so that when he passed on, there would be another griot in the community. So as you can imagine, that was a very important person in the community, because that was the person to go to if you needed to learn you know, if you're looking for a sense of identity and you want to know about your community. Now, in the modern day, if I were to design, which by the way, like I said, there are some works in motion, you know, in that direction, a Nobel Prize or Nobel Tech Prize for Africa, what we would essentially be looking for are these modern day griots. And now even though we still have oral literature, which is something the Swedish Academy probably wouldn't be interested in, it's very strong in our community, oral literature. There are so many languages in the thousands of languages in Africa. And of course, you know, like any community or any nation, sometimes whole entire continents, but usually nations, usually have a particular point of view, like in history, a particular sensibility. Now, we'd be looking for the person who kind of represents as much as possible the African sensibility. Because, like, for example, when colonialism came, virtually the entire continent was colonized. So we all relate with that, you know, what we lost, what we learned, and so forth. So we're looking for these griots who are telling these stories. That's what we'd be looking for. And the Nobel Prize for Literature does get some things right. For example, the nominations come from literary people, you know, professors or librarians and so forth, teachers of literature, even other authors and other Nobel Prize laureates. So from all over the world, so they nominate the people they think deserve the award, and these people come from you know, diverse backgrounds. So that is a good concept. So if I were designing a Nobel Prize for Africa, that I would borrow, although I would widen the net more.
And I was listening as you spoke about how this year's Nobel Prize in Literature winner, Abdulrazak Gurnah, born in Tanzania, was not really well known or known at all in the country of his birth. Will that become the case in the future, though, as people spend more time on social media? Are they really reading books? I mean, will our authors and writers become increasingly well known or less so?
No, the technology in the African context, the technology has really helped. You know, of course, it may have some drawbacks, but the advantages completely outweigh the disadvantages completely. In fact, and that's why there's been an explosion of literary expression in Africa this century, starting right from around 2000, you know, and when we start getting all these Kane prizes and all these festivals and the literary blogs and the literary stars, you can't compare it with the 90s, 80s, and you know, and earlier. The explosion was brought about by modern, you know, technology and communication methods, you know, the internet, mobile phones, social media, and so forth. And they have been a great gift to Africa. We are so well connected now in Africa, you know, digitally. For example, my work is available on an app called World Reader, which is a free mobile phone app that you can get from the Apple store. Now, the World Reader keeps very accurate statistics. It's amazing in that aspect, because you can know exactly how many people opened your book and how many finished reading it and in which place they are. Now, I bring this up because I'm more popular in Nigeria than in my own country. In fact, I'm so popular in Nigeria that I like to think of myself as an honorary Nigerian writer. And I keep telling that to my Nigerian friends, that technically I'm a Nigerian writer. Like a couple of years ago, when I was on a panel for African writers, and even that is run by a Nigerian. In fact, this very month, December 2021, I'm in a literary magazine, a digital one, called Published Africa. And it's run by a Nigerian. Now, by the way, apart from Nigeria, my work is widely read in South Africa, Ethiopia, Uganda, and some other countries. Kenya is around number five. So I've been jokingly threatening to leave, because even my own country, I'm not number one. They don't read my work as much as some other people. That's a good thing. That technology is allowing people, because moving it would have been very difficult to physically move these books. It's very expensive. But with digital technology, things like WorldReader and so forth, the blogs, you've got a lot of literary blogs. I'm sure you're aware of blogs like Brit or Paper and others that connect Africans. So they tell us where the awards are, opportunities, breakout stars. And there's so many great authors have emerged in the last 20 or so years. And all this has been made possible by technology. Now, you might say some of the older guys have been left behind, but not necessarily. You can learn a lot, people like Wole Soyinka and so forth. I don't know who runs the accounts, but they're active. And we get to know what they're up to, where they are, physically, if they're moving around, the events they're participating in. So the technology is keeping us well connected, and it's really keeping the literary blogs vibrant. It's an exciting time to be an African author. So and there's a lot of reverence for the older generation. In Kenya, in the whole of Africa, we revere Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And I'll give you one quick example. Ngugi wa Thiong'o is, apart from being an intellectual and a writer and all that, he's also a language warrior. He's well known for that. In fact, he's probably best known for that. This means that he promotes indigenous languages. Now, and actually writes in his own native Kikuyu, which is also my mother tongue. Now, Ngugi wa Thiong'o is about twice my age. And initially, even though I come from a very large community in East Africa, there are more than 10 million of us, there's a lot of hesitation in writing in local languages because a lot of people feel that their communities don't have critical mass. So books are mostly written in English and Swahili. But Ngugi wa Thiong'o has insisted on things, on people writing in their own languages, and then other, they can be translated into other languages, including the bigger languages like Mandarin or English or German or whatever. Now, thanks in a large part to Ngugi wa Thiong'o's efforts or crusade, I, who come from the same community as Ngugi wa Thiong'o, I've been writing in Kikuyu as well. So I've got a book of poetry that I'm working on, and it's entirely in Kikuyu. So also written, mostly written in English, but also written in Swahili and now Kikuyu. So inspired by Ngugi wa Thiong'o. So we, the new generation of writers, we don't say, we are cool, we are hip, we are very techie guys, and we don't need the old generation. No, I mean, we're just going one step further, and technology is really helping us.
And that was Kenyan author, playwright and critic Alexander Nderitu speaking to me from Nairobi, Kenya. Nderitu is the author of the stage play The Talking of Trees about Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai. Be sure to join me for the next Straight Talk Africa as we review Africa's most important stories and memorable moments of 2021. Was it a year to remember or one we would rather forget? We'll look at the stories that made headlines across the continent and the world in 2021. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is our show this week. Thank you to all my guests and all my VOA colleagues who helped me bring the show to you this week. We would also like to wish a warm welcome to all our new affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa now in Southern, East and West Africa. And thank you for always watching, and thank you for always listening. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.